Reading with your kids.
Hola, ni hao, konnichiwa, assalamu alaikum, shalom, mahaba, ciao, bonjour, namaste, jumbo. Bienvenidos. Hey, my name is Jed Lee. Welcome to Reading with Your Kids. We're coming to you from the beautiful, wonderful, historical neighborhood of Reedville, located in the southwest corner of Boston, Massachusetts. We are so very honored and absolutely delighted that you're joining us in our mission to help all families grow closer through reading. We do that by sharing fun, thoughtful, and thought-provoking conversations with fascinating people who just happen to be writing books for kids of all ages. You can join us in our mission by telling all of your family and friends about the show and letting them know that they can hear us on the WREB AM-FM 24/7 radio network. And they can find us on the iHeartRadio app, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, Podcast Addict, CastBox, Player FM, Audible, BoomPlay. Wherever you find your favorite shows, you can find Reading with Your Kids. Two wonderful guests for you today. First up, David Epstein is here to celebrate Range. This is a middle grade novel that was adapted from his adult book, and it has some really, really powerful information. We'll also be introducing you to Anna Siqueira. She's here to celebrate her new picture book, Vera La Valiente is Scared. This episode of Reading with Your Kids is brought to you by Careful What You Hear, a wonderful middle grade novel by Helen Dunlop Newton. Noah Baker is not an average 13-year-old. He's a mind-reading secret agent. Ever since a mix-up gave him an experimental cochlear implant, he and his partner Lena have been going on spying missions for the government. Now they're in for a reward for all of their hard work, space camp. Their fun threatens to melt away when Noah overhears thoughts revealing a plot to steal secret plans from nearby Redstone Arsenal. Should Noah report what he heard and risk losing a chance to compete in the end of camp mission with Lena? Or should he keep quiet and risk bad people winning again? Careful What You Hear is the sequel to Helen's very popular Do You Hear What I Hear? Get your copy today. You and your kids are going to love it. Careful What You Hear by Helen Dunlop Newton. This episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Once Upon a Dance. Are you worried that your kids are spending way too much time in front of their screens? Once Upon a Dance offers unplugged storytime adventures. Read, move, and imagine together. Created by a dance educator, this award-winning collection blends movement with whimsy. Perfect for families, classrooms, and libraries. You can learn more and bring stories to life by visiting onceuponadance.com. Or you can order Once Upon a Dance books at your favorite local bookstore. Once Upon a Dance, get your kids and you moving together. Hey families, would you like to share a miracle with your kids? At the Wolf Conservation Center, hope was fading. The endangered Mexican wolves dreamed of a pup, but none had come. Until one tiny miracle changed everything. Meet Trumpet, a real-life wolf pup whose incredible birth brought joy, hope, and a lesson in conservation. Trumpet the Miracle Wolf, written by Leocadia George, is a heartwarming true story that will inspire your whole family. Teach your kids the power of hope, love, and protecting endangered species. Get your copy today and join the wild adventure. Join us right now from Washington, D.C. Our guest is here today to celebrate a really important book. It's called Range. It's been adapted for middle grade readers. Please welcome to the show, David Epstein. David, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Delighted that you are on the podcast. Please give us the 30,000 feet kind of explanation of Range, please.
Yeah, I think range, the word I use to mean a breadth of experiences and interests, like being able to do more than one thing, being interested in more than one thing. And what the book argues is that that's actually a strength, that taking time to explore different interests, sometimes finding, you know, what activities you fit in the world, it doesn't have to be the first thing that you tried. And in fact, delaying that process and sampling different things actually becomes a source of strength in the long run, as opposed to a disadvantage, where sometimes people see it as just falling behind. But really, it's kind of building this broad toolbox and knowledge about yourself that pays off in the long run.
Yeah. I think that this is a super important book for kids to read, but also for parents to read. And you told me that when you set out to write the book, you didn't think of it as something that would necessarily be interesting to parents, but then something happened to you and it changed your perspective.
Yeah, I didn't think about it one way or the other. It just didn't occur to me. And then between the time I turned in the manuscript and the time the book came out, I became a father. And so, of course, suddenly I started viewing everything in my life through the lens of parenthood. And now one of my friends, a fellow writer, Ryan Holiday, told me it's a parenting book in disguise. Mm-hmm. And so I've come to take that as a compliment, because it certainly informs my approach to parenting.
Yeah. It's funny how a little kid will change the way you look at everything in life.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that kind of gets to maybe implicitly a principle that I think is important to think about in the context of what I'm writing about, which is called the end of history illusion, which is this finding in psychology that we all change more than we think we will. Like, we all recognize we changed a lot based on our experiences in the past and learned a lot, but we're like, yeah, but now I'm pretty much done. You know, so we're works in progress, constantly claiming to be finished. And actually, we always underestimate the amount that we will change in the future. And boy, do I think that's true for the experience of having a kid. Like, just so many things about your awareness about the world and your values and those things change in ways that I think are pretty hard to understand until you go through it.
Yeah. I've mentioned here on the podcast, I used to love and I would devour horror books by Stephen King and Anne Rice, and like just two or three a week. And I was in the middle of an Anne Rice vampire novel, and my son came into the world, and it was wonderful. And I went back after a couple of days after he came home from the hospital, and I went back and opened up that book, and I think I read a sentence, and I said, oh, no, I don't want to be anywhere near this universe anymore.
It's amazing, right? I think that really does testify to the fact that we can't predict who we're going to be in the future. Like, things change based on our experiences. And I think that's one of the reasons why we have to be open to new experiences and broadening our interests.
That's super. I think that's super important to mention, because I see it. I didn't experience it myself when I played baseball and football, and it was just us going down to the playground and kicking it back, and there was Little League, but it wasn't crazy like it is today. And when I played soccer in high school and college, I think out of the 8 years that I played, I think my parents might have come to two or three games, and it wasn't because they didn't love me, but it was just because they had lives to do, and it was just one thing that I did. It wasn't the end all to be all. And nowadays, it seems like kids are being pushed into organized activities and sports at a crazy young age and at a crazy intensity.
At a crazy intensity, often at crazy expense also. And I think that's important because, look, I think it's nice to have a lot of these activities. It's great. But the hyperstructure of a lot of them sometimes is because of another adult's economic interest and not really the developmental interest of the kid. So to give an example, when I live in Washington, D.C. now, but I lived in New York previously, and there was a U8 travel soccer team that met across the street from me. And I don't think there's a human being on this earth that thinks that 7-year-olds can't find good enough competition in a city of 9 million people that they need to travel. But if you weren't in the U7 travel team, then you couldn't be in U8. You know, it's like, if you wanted to even be considered for this pipeline, you had to be signed up. So this was really like a customer retention thing, as far as I'm concerned, for the people running that league, not in the long-term interest of the kids. And it's interesting because I've spent, you know, I was a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. I've spent a lot of time around elite athletes, and they're the ones who need the least convincing that kids should have more time in kind of lightly structured or semi-structured activity and be able to do multiple activities, because it's what most of they themselves did when they were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I made a living doing educational magic shows around the country for 35 to 40 years, and hosted a young magicians group at our church for about 10 or 15 years. I just opened up the door. There were other adult mentors that were teaching the kids, but the kids who were in the group saw me as somebody who was making a living doing something that they loved and hoped to do. And they would come up to me and ask for advice and what should I do next and what trick should I learn? And I always told them, take a dance class, take an acting class. And they'd look at me like I had three heads, but it's like, dude, you're going on stage. You have to be able to move and talk. But they didn't want to hear that.
That's a great point. And I mean, I have a friend named David Kwong, who's a great magician. And more than his tricks, what interests me when I watch him perform is his command of narrative, you know, so like studying narrative technique. But you're getting at something really profound that reminds me of when I was interviewing a guy named Ian Yates, who was what's called a performance pathway director in the UK. It's basically someone who's in charge of the pipeline of development for some of the elite sports. And in other countries where they have sort of more centralized sporting bodies, they have people like that. And I remember him telling me that all these parents would come to him and saying, I want my kid doing what this gold medalist or whoever is doing now, not what that gold medalist was doing when they were 12, which was totally different. And so I think it's this well-meaning. I think it's well-meaning and well-intentioned attempt to give kids a head start. The problem is, in so many cases, what we know about the science of development suggests that skipping stages backfires in the longer term, even if it leads to some advantages in the short term.
Yeah. And I'm terrible with numbers, but I was reading somewhere that statistically, these kids who are on the U8 travel team and the U9 all-star team, by the time they get to 13 or 14, they're done with that sport.
Yeah, I mean, one of the issues with when selection is pushed that early. So first of all, the earlier you push selection, the more likely you get the wrong person in the wrong sport, basically. So one of the advantages to having the so-called sampling period and delaying specialization is that people find things they're more interested in or they're better at. Another problem is that when selection's really early, you tend to get a very pronounced what's called relative age effect. So this is where, say, if kids are being selected when they're 7 or 8 or 9, some of those kids in a cohort are essentially a year older than others if they just happen to be born early in the birth cohort.
Mm-hmm.
And at age 7, 8, 9, 10, that 9, 10, 11 months of development is enormous. And so coaches will mistake biological maturation for potential. And so you'll see these youth national teams and sometimes even junior national teams will be stocked with kids that are born in the first 3 months of the year. And that disappears later on, but it's a sure sign that the selection is occurring too early.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you even see effects in this for school, like boys who are born late in their birth cohort are much more likely to get diagnosed with ADHD. And it's just because they're almost a year younger and they're just acting younger. And so, sometimes I think we look at a kid and say, oh, they're behind, but development is not so linear and obvious as that.
Right, right. What inspired you to create Range?
Yeah, there were a few things that came together. For one, there's always an element, I realize, of me-search in all of my projects. There are things that I want to understand, about my own life. Uh-huh. or get better at. But there were a few specific things in this case. Like, I wrote a book called The Sports Gene, about when I was at Sports Illustrated, about genetics and athleticism. And it brought me into a public debate with Malcolm Gladwell, you know, maybe like the most famous nonfiction science writer ever. Mm-hmm. And that debate was supposed to be about athletic development specifically. And so we talked about some of these issues we're talking about. And in preparation for the debate, I went and looked at all this research. You know, we know that elite athletes spend more time in like very focused practice than lower level athletes. But I went and looked at the research that actually tracked people from the time they were young. And then it showed a different pattern where early on, they often practiced, you know, in a less structured way and less volume than people who plateaued at lower levels. And the future elites usually had this sampling period where they try a variety of activities. They gain broad general skills that scaffold later more technical skills. They learn about their own interests and abilities, and they delay specializing until later than peers who plateau at lower levels. And as we were talking about this, so after this kind of debate, we became running buddies and would talk about it on our own time. And I would say, you know, everyone thinks about this Tiger Woods story where he did specialize really early. And nobody talks about Roger Federer's development, where he did a ton of different sports and delayed specializing until later than his peers, even though the Roger Federer one is the norm, according to the science, mm-hmm. and the Tiger Woods one is the exception. And so Malcolm and I would literally talk about the Roger versus Tiger problem, and that ended up being the intro of the book, the Roger story versus the Tiger story. And the rest of the book is not really about sports, but that just became this frame for, well, let's look in other areas of life. Of when is it better to be a Roger versus a Tiger? So it was kind of motivated by that debate and also by this interaction that I had. Well, my own career changing. Like, I've career zigzagged a bunch of times. I was training to be a scientist in my past life, and I found these oddball experiences to end up as sources of power instead of liabilities. Uh-huh. I also had this experience where I was invited to talk to a group of like former Navy SEALs, basically, who were now carving other careers in the world. It was just a small group, you know, a dozen, 15 people, something like that. And this was while I was having these discussions with Malcolm, and I was looking at research in other areas about these benefits for late starters, like Nobel laureate scientists are about 22 times more likely than their peers to have hobbies in the arts and music and things like that. And so I just talked to them a little bit about some of this research, and it was like the catharsis for them. Like, they were coming up being, oh, I felt like I was so behind and could never succeed. Like, do you have more of this research? I mean, some of these people, I remember one of them came up, he was in grad school at Harvard after having been a Navy SEAL, and he was, you know, feeling neurotic about being behind and all this stuff. And so this just suggested to me that there were a lot of people out there who needed to hear the message that having this broader toolbox and broad base of experiences is an asset, not a liability in the longer term.
Yeah. Was it your idea to adapt Range for younger kids, or was it the publisher came up and said, we got to sell this to a bigger audience?
No, it was my idea. One of my friends, who was also a science writer, had done a young reader adaptation. I thought it was really cool. I like schools. and so it was my idea. So I kind of pushed for it. And I suggested, when I pitched it to a publishing imprint, I kind of had a structure that I suggested, because it's about a third the length of the adult version. And so I suggested what to cut out and what to keep, and moved in a new story or two. Like, after the publication of the original version, I had this encounter with Serena Williams, where she told me that the portrayal of her childhood was not usually accurate, and that she had played taekwondo and track and field and ballet, gymnastics and all these other things. Then her father took her off the traveling circuit when it was getting too intense so that she could focus on school. And since she told me that, I wanted to include that. So there were a few stories here and there that I learned after the publication of the original book that I thought would resonate with a younger audience. So I moved them in as well.
Yeah. I love it. You know, I was telling David before we hit record that in my own family, my daughter was quite a talented dancer. She started very early just because we wanted to give her something to do and to burn off her energy. And at four, she was on a competition team and they won a national championship. And the reaction that her dance coach had was, oh, next year we're going to Europe and we're going to be in internationals and we're going to dance 17 hours a week. And I said, absolutely not. And, you know, took my daughter out of that studio and found another place for her. And she didn't win any international competitions, but she still dances today at age 29. And she does it for fun. And it brings her great joy. And it's a great health benefit. And I like to think back that that's one of the best decisions my beautiful wife and I ever made.
You know, that's fantastic to hear that she's still doing it, too, because a lot of the research shows that when there's like a very abrupt increase in intensity for young people, their likelihood of burning out and quitting is it skyrockets. Mm-hmm. If you don't follow a more sort of slow progression of training intensity, if that's what they want to do. One, I think it gives them a chance to realize, decide, is this something they really want to do?
Mm-hmm.
But both from a physical and psychological standpoint, the chance of quitting and never doing the thing again, basically, skyrockets if you have this sort of abrupt transition.
Yeah, yeah. And what is the biggest message? You know, obviously getting this message of generalizing and giving kids opportunities is a great message for families to hear. But what specific message are you hoping the kids hear, kids who might be pushing? Are you thinking that maybe this is going to give a kid who's being pushed into playing football 30 hours a week to the ammunition to say, yo, Dad, David Epstein's an expert at this, and he thinks.
Maybe. You know, I don't know how many kids would have kind of the wherewithal to do that, but I hope that – I mean, to be honest, to some degree, I hope – so one thing that I didn't necessarily expect, like when I was writing the adult version of Range, I'm thinking about human performance, you know, and there's a lot in it about innovation and science and music and how people become great at these things. What I didn't expect, one of the most common reactions from people who read it was to say, I felt seen, right? Mm. Maybe they felt behind at some point in their life. Maybe they're in a transition right now. Maybe they're wondering, there are other interests they want to explore, but they're like, I don't know, is that a good use of time? Because they're thinking about in instrumental terms, like how will it pay off in sort of specific terms? And so I would hear from people who it kind of gave them the courage to explore some interest that they really wanted to explore anyway, or it made them feel less anxious about some switch or trying something new. And I kind of hope that's the same for kids, because there was an OECD study not that long ago that found that kids really start in most countries really start narrowing what they view as their potential prospective careers around age 7. I don't think that's ideal, and that wasn't always the case. So, you know, I really would like kids to feel less anxious about and motivated to keep their brains open for these interests that might come to them. Like you're on a path, you're always going to be on a certain path, but don't put blinders on to these opportunities that might come along. I mean, in my life, when I was a teenager, I had it all mapped out. I was going to go to the Air Force Academy. I was going to be a test pilot. I was going to be an astronaut. I didn't do any of those things. And all of the things that became the most important in my career were things that I could not have predicted, where an opportunity arose, it interested me, and I pivoted to it, and it opened some new, larger world for me. I was actually just in Angela Duckworth's class last week. Angela Duckworth is the professor who became famous for studying and writing about grit, you know, persistence and perseverance, and how important that is for getting good grades and other outcomes in life. And I would say she's actually nuanced her, like she invited me to class, because she wanted me to talk about how before you decide where to apply your grit, you should go through this sampling period. That's why I was there. And she was giving her students at Penn this talk about different emotions, and she was showing some of the research that showed that, you know, we tell people to follow their passion, but that enjoyment and interest are actually are related but different emotions, mm-hmm. and that you really want to be really sensitive to interest. Like, does mm-hmm. this thing interest me? If so, let me try a little more. Does it still interest me? And really keeping a feelers out for engagement and finding things that feel engaging, and if you do that, the research shows that by finding something that really engages you, you will then be much more likely to display all these characteristics of grit anyway, without trying to be gritty. And so I just hope that kids will feel more okay to explore some of those interests and to keep an open mind about other things they might try.
Yeah. I see parents and experience this with my kids when they were young and looking at their peers. There's so much pressure put on kids that they have to get into the best high school. They have to get into the best colleges, and you have to do all these travel sports teams because you need a scholarship to go to college. And boy, I just think that's not very healthy at all.
And I mean, I also think that there's plenty of research showing that we vastly, vastly overestimate the effects of specific high schools and specific colleges. I think there's plenty of research to show that if a school is terrible, that that's bad, like, and the kids are deprived, that that's really bad. But that above certain thresholds, they're not making as much difference as we might like to think.
Mm-hmm.
I know I was in that mindset. You know, I desperately wanted to get into an elite college, and I did. And in retrospect and reading the research, now I realize that it was not as important as I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a neighbor of mine wrote a book about college admissions where he was embedded with admissions committees from three different colleges, different levels of selectivity. And he wrote also about the history of admissions, and it wasn't always as crazy and anxiety provoking. And part of what he goes over in the history is that there was a guy who became very successful in political ads, like direct mailing for political ads, and just saw parental anxiety as an opportunity to do direct mailing for college admissions ads and to just like ramp up the pressure. And that would be big business for him. And so I think it's a little bit of a collective trap where everyone gets caught in this feeling that this is a competition, and really people should be looking for fit when it comes to these to kinds of schools, but also that where you go to college, not one of the most important thing decisions that's going to be made in your life. And you know, most of us realize that many years later, I think.
Many years later, as you're struggling to pay off that college loan, student loan. What's next for you? What else are you going to be working on?
Well, I just finished another book, so it's in the copy editing phase right now, and it's coming out in the spring. It's called Inside the Box, How Constraints Make Us Better. So to me, in some ways, it feels like a natural follow-up to Range where, you know, once you get this broad toolbox and broad experiences, at some point you focus those into things, projects and achievement, and so it felt like a natural next question to me. So yeah, it's coming out in May.
Awesome. And do you intend to create a young reader edition of that book too?
I would love to. I loved doing the adaptation. I think the cover is super cool. Like, it's very vibrant, much more so than the adult version. And I thought it was fun. You know, we changed the subtitles, Range, How Exploring Your Interests Can Change the World. And so that's more of the kind of content that I kept. And I liked how you could do sort of breakout boxes for specific topics. And one of the chapters, I got into examples of math learning a little more than I did in the adult version. So I found it quite fun. So I will certainly pitch an adaptation again, and then it will be up to a publishing imprint to decide if they'll take me up on it.
Awesome. We should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about Range and more about you.
DavidEpstein.com. All my stuff is around there, and I have a free Substack newsletter called Range Widely that's just at DavidEpstein.substack.com.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of Range, adapted for young kids, for young middle grade readers. Our guest has been David Epstein. Dave, thanks for being on Reading With Your Kids.
Hey, it's totally a pleasure.
Hey, my friends, I have a super idea you are going to love. How about this weekend, turn your backyard cookout into a storybook celebration? Fire up the grill, crack open a few of your favorite picture books, and serve up Big Fork Brand's legendary bacon sausage. Made with nitrate-free bacon and premium pork, it's juicy, smoky, and unforgettable. Top it off with Big Fork's spicy Chicago Fire sauce, and you've got a meal as bold as the characters in your favorite bedtime tale. Get 20% off your order using the promo code READ at BigForkBrands.com. That's BigForkBrands.com, promo code READ to get 20% off, because nothing brings families together like great food, great books, and a whole lot of flavor. Big Fork Brands. Read, grill, repeat. Hey, my friends. You know one of my favorite parts of the day is story time. There's just something magical about snuggling up with your kids, opening a great book, and escaping into an adventure together. And let me tell you, that moment becomes even more magical when you're curled up in the softest, coziest bedding you've ever felt.
That's why I'm so excited that CozyEarth.com is supporting Reading with Your Kids. Their bamboo sheets, comforters, and pajamas are unbelievably soft, naturally breathable, and temperature regulating, which means no more sweaty nights or chilly toes. Right now, Cozy Earth is offering Reading with Your Kids listeners an unbelievable and exclusive 41% off their entire site. That's right, you heard me right, 41% off. So go ahead, create your own cozy reading nook, wrap yourself and your kids up in something comfy, grab your favorite bedtime book, and turn story time into the best part of your day. Head on over to CozyEarth.com and use the promo code READ at checkout to save 41%. That's CozyEarth.com, promo code READ. Hey, real quick, we want to let you know that this episode of Reading With Your Kids is brought to you by Zivo Life. Zivo.life. Zivo Life. Hey, parents, caregivers, and book lovers, ever wish you had a little bit more zip in your step when you're reading The Very Hungry Caterpillar for the fifth or the 50th time today? Say hello to Zivo Life, your new best friend in daily wellness. Zivo Life is the world's most nutrient-dense whole plant, loaded with 50% plant protein, essential amino acids, fiber, antioxidants, and so much more. It's a powerhouse in just one teaspoon a day. And yes, it's giving people more energy, better gut health, and even healthier skin and hair. If you want to feel more energized, focused, and vibrant during your next animated storytime performance, Zivo Life might just be your secret weapon. Visit Zivo.life, Zivo.life, and use the promo code READ to get 30% off your order. It comes with a 30-day risk-free guarantee, and you've got nothing to lose except your sluggishness. Go now to Zivo.life and use the promo code READ and save 30%. Join us right now from Tampa in the wonderful state of Florida. Our guest is here today to celebrate. Her new picture book is called Vera La Valiente Is Scared. Please welcome to the show, Anna Siqueira. Anna, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
You're very, very welcome. Tell me, who is Vera and why is she scared?
So Vera is the name of my sister. My sister was always the brave one. So the character in the book, Vera, is very valiente, very brave. She climbs like a dolphin. She climbs like a mountain goat, dives like a dolphin. She defends her friends. But when she hears that the class is going on a field trip to the roller coaster park, she gets really scared because she's really scared of roller coaster, but also she's scared that her friends are going to discover that she's not that brave. Mm-hmm. So that's a Vera La Valiente. And it's based on my sister Vera and my son, João, because my son was always scared of roller coasters. So they were like kind of the opposite. Vera was the brave and my son was the scary cat.
Well, you can't be afraid of roller coasters down in Florida. My goodness, you're surrounded by them.
I know, but I am scared now. When I was a teenager, I would love roller coasters. I would go to other roller coasters. Right now, I go to some of them, but don't make me go in the Busch Gardens. They have that one called Shikra, something like that, that you have to go like basically upside down. That one, nobody's going to make me go on that one. So I agree with Vera. We have to put our limits, and that's what she's going to show in the book. You have to put your own limits.
Well, you know, that's a great lesson for kids is that, you want to be brave enough to try things and try new things and get out there and meet people and do some scary things. But you also have to know your limits and know that it's okay to say no.
Yes, yes. That's what, like, my son, I'm kind of proud of him now. When he was little, I was like, I would push him. Come on, try. But he was always like very determined. No, I don't like it. I'm scared. I'm not going to go. And now I see that as a sign of bravery because sometimes, you know, it's hard for you to say, no, I'm not brave enough. I don't want to do that. And that's what Vera, in the end, she's going to discover that it's a sign of bravery to say, I'm scared, I don't want to go. Mm-hmm. And she's going to try a little roller coaster, but she's not ready for the big one yet. And that's okay. We have to go at our own pace and find our own path to bravery.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm like you and Vera. You know, back in the day when all roller coaster did was go up and down. there are some now that I see that take off at like 100 miles an hour.
Oh my gosh!
And they go and there's no track, and then it flips down and connects. Yeah, I don't need that.
No. There are some crazy ones now. So, yes, you have to see which ones you can go, which one is a little bit too much for you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Vera, is this your 12th or 14th book?
That is my ninth book.
Ninth book, yeah.
Yeah, my picture book. Yeah.
What inspired? Cause I noticed on your website that you're a teacher. Mm-hmm. What was it that inspired you to start writing children's books?
Well, I wrote children's book in the past a long, long time ago when I lived in Brazil. I'm from Brazil. Mm-hmm. So I did write two books in Brazil, got them published. And then I moved here to United States in 1991, I think. And then I stopped writing because it was, first of all, it was not my language. And then I had kids. I was going to college. I was working. So I just stopped writing. You know, I was not writing picture books anymore. But then when I was teaching Spanish, I teach Spanish, and I was teaching a class to my second graders, and I like to teach Spanish through stories. So I was teaching them through a lot of stories, and they told me about a video, and it's a very viral video. I don't know if you've seen that video, The Duck Song. Have you ever watched That Duck Song?
The Duck Song? No, I
haven't. Oh, you have to watch it. It is a very annoying duck that goes to the lemonade stand every day and asks for grapes. So every day he said, you got grapes? And the guy said, no, I have lemonade. And he comes every day and he's very annoying, but there's a cute song. So my kids love that video, my students. So I watched the video and I wrote in Spanish, that one is for the educational market. I wrote a story based on that duck in Spanish, and of course I asked authorization for the songwriter, and we worked together on a project, and I sold that story to Teachers Discovery. It's an educational market. So after that, I decided just to go back to writing picture books again. I don't know, the kids inspired me to go back to writing picture books. And that's when I started. But I had to relearn a lot because, of course, it had been a long, long time without writing. And everything was very different, right? The writing styles. And also because I'm from Brazil and I was writing in Portuguese. In Brazil, the storytelling is different too. So I had to relearn a lot. I did a lot of courses and webinars and got into 6 critique groups and did a lot of reading. We go to my library. I still go to my library 2-3 times a week and get every time I get 25 books and read them because it really gets you inspired and show you a lot of the new things going in the market. So that was my inspiration, was my second grade kids. I'm still thankful to them. They now are in high school, but, you know, it was a great inspiration for me.
Yeah. A couple of years back, we had an intern with us, working with us, who was originally from Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about the differences in the children's books that are published for the United States and children's books that are published for countries in Latin America. And she had a wonderful series in Spanish, interviewing a number of different authors from Latin America. You were saying that the storytelling is different in Brazil. Could you talk a little bit about the difference between, you know, beyond just the language, between books that are published for an American audience and books that are published for an audience in Brazil and other parts of Latin America?
Well, right now, I'm not as familiar with the Brazilian children's book market right now because I have been here for so long and I haven't been really reading a lot of books in Brazil. But for example, when I came to this country in 1991, I translated my book that I had published in Brazil that was called A Lua Namoradeira. That means the flirting moon. And it was a book about a moon, and the moon was blinking. And then a girl who was also into science, she gets together and convinces the astronauts to go see what's going on with the moon. They go and find a little something in the moon's eye. They take it out. But then the moon keeps blinking and because winking at people because now she wants to flirt. So when I came, I translated. I asked somebody to check my English, and I went to a conference because I was very brave, like Vera the Valiente. I got my story and I went to the conference. And seriously, the editor, what the editor told me at that time, and that was a while ago too, maybe now it would be different, I don't know. She told me, your book is weird. And not in a good way, you know, it's weird because you mix fantasy with reality because it's a fantasy, but it's also reality. So I don't know. I think like at that time in Brazil, you know, you had more room to mix reality and fantasy and kids and adults and create your own world based on what you thought it was fun. This book got honorable mention from the Academia Brasileira de Letras. That's the Brazilian Academy of Letters. I don't know how we would say that here. Uh-huh. But it is really a very prestigious prize. But here it was seen like a weird book. So you can see the difference, right? So there are, I think, like, at that time, and maybe now that book wouldn't be considered as weird because I think now we have more fantasy and stuff, but I don't know. That was one of the things that also made me stop writing for a while. I said, okay, my stories are weird. I also had one about the other one who got published was about a giant, and people told me it was too scary because the giant would get into the kid's nightmare and do all kinds of things. He would come. He really wanted to be a friend with the kid, but he would come into his nightmare wearing different costumes, different things, and the kid was really scared. And they said, that's too scary. You know, that is way too scary. That giant comes into a kid nightmare. Yeah. So
that's the idea that your book was weird because it mixed fantasy and reality. I mean, every fantasy that I've ever read mixed fantasy and
I know. That's what I'm saying. Maybe because that was in 1991, maybe now they wouldn't see my book as weird. I don't know. But that editor told me my book was weird.
Wow. I don't know what to tell you. My favorite book when I was growing up was a book called Mr. Bear Goes to Boston, and it told the story of a bear in the North Woods of Maine who bought a train ticket to come down to Boston and went around to Paul Revere's house. That's pretty weird.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. Weird can be good, right? Yes, weird can be good. Can be positive.
What has it been like now that you've adjusted your style? So folks don't think that your writing is weird. Do you kind of miss those days where you had a bit more room to write books that might be a little scary or a little weird?
No, I think, you know, I still try to put a lot of imagination in my books. For example, my book, If Your Babysitter is a Bruja, is a girl who imagines her babysitter to be a bruja, and it has a lot of, it's not scary, it's a little spooky, let's see, but it's not scary. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying now to write another spooky, now it's very trendy, spooky books, picture books. And my granddaughter, she is 4, and she always tells me, tell me a spooky story. Tell me a creepy story. So I'm telling her so many creepy stories that now I'm going to have to write another creepy picture book. So I'm in the process of thinking about a creepy picture book. I do want to write another one. So I'm in the process of that.
That's fantastic. It's interesting. Your native language is Portuguese. You're here teaching Spanish. And it seems between Vera La Valiente and your book about the Bruja, you're kind of writing books that mix English and Spanish together. Why not English and Portuguese?
Well, for now, I'm trying to do English and Portuguese, but since the Spanish market is bigger, so most of the editors prefer it in Spanish, but also I am a Spanish teacher. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I want to teach my kids Spanish, and also I'm in a blended family, Cuban, Brazilian, American. So we do speak Spanish, Portuguese, and English in my house. It's a big mix. Mm-hmm. So, consider that the Spanish population, of course, is much bigger than the Brazilian population. That's, and being a Spanish teacher, I do want to teach all the kids Spanish because I think learning a language is very important. And here in Florida, learning Spanish is basically a must. Mm-hmm. So I really want to, of course, they're not going to learn just by reading the book, but maybe they will feel interest, right? And they will get that passion. Oh, I want to learn Spanish. But also, I want the kids who are Hispanic to see themselves in books and feel proud. So when I go on an author's visit, for example, I always tell that speaking more than one language is a superpower. And you should be proud of that. So they get so proud when I say a word in Spanish. I said, well, who knows what that word means? And they all raise their hands. So I want them to feel proud of their heritage, of their language, of their culture. So that's also why I want to write in Spanish. But I am trying. I wrote one book, a board book called Our World, Brazil, right? It's from Barefoot Books. They have this board book series of many different countries. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about Brazil. So it does have Portuguese words in it. I'm sold a chapter book series that it is about monsters and legends. Oh yeah, my chapter book is pretty spooky, but it doesn't have fantasy, but it is based on a girl called Carolina. She comes from Brazil to United States. And she's trying to find all those legends and monsters from Brazil here in the United States. So the first one is about Cuca, who is it's not Cucuy or Cuco. Cuca is an alligator witch. And she does gobble up kids who are disobedient and all of that. But she doesn't look like a Cucuy. And it's very fun because they think that the first one, she will think the teacher, her teacher is Cuca. So it's really very humorous, a little spooky, but does not have fantasy because it's all based on what she thinks the teacher is doing and imagining with a lot of imagination, but not fantasy. Mm. But it's a book series. So we're going to have Lobisomem, that's like similar to the werewolf, and another one I think is going to be Cobra Grande, is a big snake in Brazil that is very famous. That she has two kids, one kid, a boy. He doesn't want to be a snake anymore. He wants to be a regular boy, so he has to figure out a way to get transformed into a regular boy. Awesome. So yeah,
that sounds like an awful lot of fun. Anna, one of the things that I was really surprised to learn a few years back is that here in Massachusetts, the second most spoken language is Portuguese, not Spanish.
Wow. Yeah, there's a big Brazilian community there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe Portuguese too. I don't know. Maybe Portuguese.
Brazilian, Cape Verdean, and Portuguese, but certainly a big.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's nice.
We should tell everybody where they can go to find out more about Vera La Valiente is Scared and find out more about all the great books that you've written.
Okay, so if they go on my website, it's Anna with just one A, A-N-A, fiction.com. There I have all the books. They can go to my main page and then they can go to each book separately to learn about all the books, the reviews. And also I have a lot of, for the teachers, I have a lot of teachers activity guides, videos. I have a YouTube channel called Anna Teacher Writer. Again, Anna just went in. And that I also make videos like teaching, for example, for Vera. I think it's a very good book. Even the school library journal made sure that it's a very good book to teach expressive language, because she talks a lot with similes. She always says, I'm scared as a chick being chased by a wolf. My heart is frozen as an icy mountain. So she is always talking in similes. So I have videos about teaching similes, getting ideas. So some writing videos for kids, for the teachers to use with kids, and many other activity guides and things on my website or my YouTube channel.
We've had a great time speaking to the author of Vera La Valiente Is Scared. Our guest has been Anna Sequeira. Anna, thanks so much for being on Reading With Your Kids.
Thank you so much for talking to authors. I enjoy a lot listening to your podcast.
Thank you. That's it for today's chapter of Reading With Your Kids. Thanks for joining us on this adventure. If this episode made you smile or made you think, please share it with someone you love. Leave a 5-star review and smash that subscribe button. I want to thank the folks who made today's show so amazing and wonderful, starting with our guest, David Epstein. Please be sure to check out Range. Also, Anna Sequeira. Please be sure to meet Vera La Valiente. Also want to thank my team, Fatima Khan, Chris Daugherty. I want to thank our wonderful sponsors. You know, when you use our promo code READ, you score a great deal, and we may earn a small commission that helps keep the podcast magical and free for families everywhere. I want to give a great big hug to my beautiful wife for all the support she gives me. Most of all, we want to thank you. Please remember, reading together is a real magic that connects us one story at a time. I'll be looking for you in the next episode of Reading With Your Kids. Until then, keep turning those pages and sharing those smiles.
Forward, dance to your own beat. With magic in your heart, you can't be.